Das Thakur ki Jai, Brahmsi Kahoji, Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Adaita Gadadhar, Sri Vasari, Sri Gaura Bhaktarindi ki Jai, Rama Vera Bhaktarindi ki Jai, Gaura Premanande, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the lotus feet of Sri Guru and Gauranga. What is the verse for the day? 325. 5? 5. Okay. Can you get it in here? I can do it on the computer here. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This morning from Srimad Bhagavatam. This is Canto 3, Text 25, which is entitled The Glories of Devotional Service. In this chapter, Kapila Dev teaches his mother, Devahuti. Somebody need to translate or anything, okay? With this? Okay. Okay, the verses up there. Maitreya
Maitreya
Uvacha
Uvacha
Pitari
Pitari
Prastitte
Prastitte
Aranyam
Aranyam
Matuhu
Matuhu
Priya
Priya
Chikirshaya
Chikirshaya
Tasmin
Tasmin
Bindu Sare
Bindu Sare
Avasit
Avasit
Bhagavan
Bhagavan
Kapila
Kapila
Kila
Kila
Maitreya Uvacha
Maitreya Uvacha
Pittari prastite ranyam
Pittari prastite ranyam
Mattu priya chikirshaya
Mattu priya chikirshaya
Tasmin bindu sarevasi
Tasmin bindu sarevasi
Bhagavan kapila kila
Bhagavan kapila kila
Maitreya uvacha
Maitreya uvacha
Pittari prastite ranyam
Pittari prastite ranyam
Madhu Priya Chikirshaya
Madhu Priya Chikirshaya
Tasmin Bindu Sare Vasi
Tasmin Bindu Sare Vasi
Bhagavan Kapila Kila
Bhagavan Kapila Kila
Maitreya Uvacha
Maitreya Uvacha
Pittari prastite ranyam
Pittari prastite ranyam
Mat priya chikirshaya
Mat priya chikirshaya
Tasmin bindu sare vasi
Tasmin bindu sare vasi
Bhagavan kapila Kila-kila.
Kila-kila.
Maitreya uvacha.
Maitreya uvacha.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Asmin bindu sare vasi.
Tasmin bindu sare vasid.
Bhagavan
kapila kila.
Maitreya uvacha.
Maitreya uvacha.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Asmin bindu sare
Tasmin bindu sare vatsit.
Bhagavan kapila kila.
Bhagavan kapila kila.
Maitreya uvacha.
Maitreya uvacha.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Tasmin bindu sare vatsi.
Tasmin bindu sare vatsi.
Bhagavan kapila kila.
Bhagavan kapila kila.
Maitreya uvacha.
Maitreya uvacha.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Tasmin bindu sare vasi.
Tasmin bindu sare vasi.
Bhagavan kapila kila.
Bhagavan kapila kila.
Maitreya uvacha.
Maitreya uvacha.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Itari prasthite ranyam.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Matu priya chikirshaya.
Tasmin bindu sare vasi.
Tasmin bindu sare vasi.
Bhagavan kapila kila.
Bhagavan kapila kila.
Maitreya uvacha.
Maitreya uvacha.
Maitreya said.
Maitreya said.
Pitari.
Pitari.
When the father.
When the father.
Prasthite.
Prasthite.
Left.
Left.
Aranyam.
Aranyam.
For the forest.
For the forest.
Matuhu.
Matuhu.
His mother.
His mother.
Priya chikirshaya.
Priya chikirshaya.
With a desire to please.
With a desire to please.
Tasmin.
Tasmin.
On that.
On that.
Bindu sare.
Bindu sare.
Lake Bindu Sarorava.
Lake Bindu Sarorava.
Avasit.
Avasit.
He stayed.
He stayed.
Bhagavan.
Bhagavan.
The Lord.
The Lord.
Kapilaha.
Kapilaha.
Kapila.
Kapila.
Kila,
Kila,
indeed.
Indeed.
Translation. Maitreya said, when Kardama left for the forest, Lord Kapila stayed on the strand. Strand is another word for shore. Stayed on the strand of Bindu Sarorava to please his mother, Devahuti. Srila Prabhupada's purport. In the absence of the father, it is the duty of the grown son to take charge of his mother and to serve her to the best of his ability so that she will not feel separation from her husband. And it is the duty of the husband to leave home as soon as there is a grown son to take charge of his wife and family affairs. That is the Vedic system of household life. One should not remain continually implicated in household affairs up to the time of death. He must leave. Family affairs and the wife may be taken charge of by a grown son. Shrima Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravari Pacharane Nirvishesha Sunyavaru Paschacha Desartarane Omangyanam Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chaksuru Militam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namah Vanchakalpatrubhyascha Kripasindubhyeva cha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namaha. So this is really in this chapter Kapila Dev is going to explain the principles of devotional service, Sankhya Yoga, but in the theistic form, the original form, through his mother, Devahuti. So, of course, Kardama Muni, his father, was a very great yogi. But he decided to get married, and Swayambhuva Manu brought his daughter, described his black-eyed daughter, Devahuti, to him to serve as his wife. And it's a strange match in a way, because Kardama Muni was a renounced yogi living in a little cottage, whereas Devahuti was a princess, king's daughter, Swayambhuva Manu's great king. And so she just, as it was done in those days, she accepted the vows of her husband. And so she also performed austerities and penances and so on, like an ascetic. And so she became very skinny and didn't look so good. Very difficult for her, because she, as a princess, of course, she had a palace and servants and was nice and taken care of. So Kardama Muni became compassionate, and he said, well, he would try to satisfy her. So he was a mystic. He had many cities, mystic powers. A lot of his mystic powers, he created a palace, huge palace, with gardens, servants, fountains, wonderful rooms filled with gems. All this has been described already. And it could fly. It was like a kind of a Vimana, a spaceship. So you see a little guy in the forest living with a hut without toilets or anything like that. You think he's not very advanced, but then he can make something much better than we can do because of his cities. So then he took her on a kind of a tour before beginning family life, and they traveled all over the universe like a big, what they call a honeymoon. And by Devahuti had 9 daughters. And then they were married to various great persons like Daksha and so on. And one son was this Kapila Dev, who was an incarnation of Krishna. And Kapila Dev, there's a list of these great souls that are called Mahajanas. He's one of the great authorities. Swayambhu, Narada, Shambhu, Kumara, Kapila, Manu, Prahlad, Janaka, Bhishma, Bali, Shukadeva Goswami, and Yamaraj is the one who gives this list. He says it myself. These are the Mahajana Yena Gita Sapanta. Says that the path of devotional service is to, the secret of devotional service is to follow the path of the Mahajanas. This was brought up Yudhisthira at a yaksha in the forest who asked him some riddles or questions. And he says, what is the panta? What is the path? And Yudhisthira gave a very famous answer. Tarko pratishta, how do you know the path? Well, he says, tarko pratishta, reason and logic is without a foundation. That won't work. It means, let's say you have a deductive argument. Now, it's perfectly valid logical argument. It has premises and it has conclusions. If you, even though it's a valid argument, if you don't like the conclusion, all you have to do is reject one of the premises. So all an argument, valid argument, deductive argument does is tell you the price you have to pay for rejecting the conclusion. Like for example, in logic classes, they give us the example of a simple deductive argument. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Right? Perfectly valid argument. Well, say I'm Socrates and I don't want to be mortal. So what do I say? Oh, how do you know all men are mortal? Have you seen every one of them? Maybe, maybe I'm different. See, or Socrates, how do you know I'm a man? Maybe I'm a god. Something, you know, so you could always, so tarko pratishta, you can't really establish anything by logic. Suteo vibhina, and if you want to quote scriptures, well, there's all kinds of different scriptures and they have different divisions and one says this and one says that. So now you go to the great sages, but nasa vrishyata matam sabinam, you cannot be a sage or a rishi or a professor, an expert, an academic expert, unless you disagree with all the others. So that's not good. So, mahajana yena katasapanta, dharmasya tattvam nihitam guhayam, the secrets of dharma, the truths of dharma are hid in the hearts of the great souls. And the path is to follow in the footsteps of those mahajanas, those great personalities, great personages. So then, in the Bhagavatam, the mahajanas are, there's a list of the best of them, Swayambhu, Narada, Shambhu, Kapila. So Kapila is listed as one of these mahajanas. They follow these principles of devotional service. So here, so Kapila will explain devotional service to his mother Devahuti. So what happened is, this is the standard system of Varnashrama Dharma, which lays out the plan for life. And then it says, say if a man lives 100 years, it's the first 25 years is student life, brahmacharya. Then 25 years married. So that brings us up to the age of 50. So 50, vanaprastha, retired life. That's where they go to the forest. And then the last, sannyas. This is the system. This is if your aim of life is self-realization. This sounds really weird to us because our aim of life is sense gratification and economic development for the purpose of sense gratification. But this is the system, so that really only one fourth of life is engaged in material affairs, household or life. And the first 25 years, celibate, brahmacharya. Vanaprastha, actually the husband and wife can stay together for vanaprastha, but they also become celibate. No more children. The children are supposedly grown. You have a family concern or whatever, you can take it over. They can take everything over and you leave. And travel to the forest or the places of pilgrimage, and and so on. So this is the system, this Varnashrama Dharma established by Krishna. This is at least for the Brahmanas. They would do like this. So therefore, as soon as he has a grown son that can take care of his wife, he leaves. So here's another thing, of course, it was considered in these times that women should be protected or taken care of by men. This sounds very strange to the modern ears, where the whole tendency of the modern world is the distinction between the sexes are becoming dissolved pretty much. And we see actually that these things, many things that used to be thought that only men were capable of doing, women turn out to be perfectly capable of doing also. And so many times Prabhupada sounds very old-fashioned, you know, obsolete and sexist to us. So let me just explain a little bit about this. The modern situation is really an artifact of advanced industrial society. And one thing we see, and one of the artifacts, one of the things that comes from that of modern society is the separation of sex from reproduction. If you see in the Bhagavatam, or Bhagavad Gita, everywhere, a few hundred years ago, the idea of sex and reproduction are tied closely together, very closely together. Now they've been completely separated, partially because of contraception and abortion and things like that, whereas it's just is no longer a consideration. But really, you have to understand that Prabhupada considers that modern industrial society, advanced industrial society, is an artificial overdevelopment of the mode of passion, and that it will not last. We think of it as progress, you know, starting with the Industrial Revolution and everything. And now look at this computer, you know, I mean, isn't this progress? Kapila Dev didn't have this computer. You know what he had? He had a memory. It wasn't so advanced. We think that if somebody can sit and do a bunch of mathematics in his head and come out with an answer, he's less advanced than the person that has a modern calculator. But these are all our crutches, our prosthetic devices, because we are incapacitated. Anyway, this modern technological advanced society, industrial society, is not natural, and it will come to its artificial. And Prabhupada really advocates very strictly when he wants to reestablish Varnashram Dharma, he wants to return to an agrarian society where people did not congregate in cities, that whatever industry was there was done in little cottages, none of the what Prabhupada calls the modern soul-killing factories, the dark satanic mills that Milton talked about, and that this is the best system for human life. Not only for living well materially, and it doesn't mean that you go to an agrarian society, you go back to some horrible way of life, impoverished. Now, if you do it right, you have everything you need, but you don't have a big money economy, and there's no unnecessary production of unnecessary things. And this is the system. If you talk about this system of Varnashram Dharma, you can only understand it. And also this idea of men and women, if you understand this agrarian society, what it is like. Because in an agrarian society, the family becomes the unit not only of consumption, but of production. And in an agrarian society, children are an asset. It's a disaster if you don't have children. You need them very much, because children become economically productive at about the age of 5. They start to do work around the farm or the little business, right? And so you have a big family, and then as they grow up, you have workers that are your own children who work all together in the family enterprise. As they work it, they learn it from you. And then when the parents get older, there's their pension, their social security, their welfare. They take care of their parents in old age. This is a system, huh? Until very recently, you see it in India, now it's also going away. I just read in a newspaper in Bengal, there's big uproar because finally, you know, the government is starting to take agrarian agricultural land and put factories there. Tata's putting a big factory up and all the people are being thrown out of the land and everything. Because everywhere is going into industrial now. Huh? It's just this is the modern world. We think as soon as the whole world is industrialized, all our problems will be solved. Of course, the problems are just beginning. But this is the system. So children in an agrarian system are very, very valuable. Not only that. But in addition to their people loving their children, the children are also just economically productive, and so they also have this additional value. Now, what happens in an industrial society? We can see that in an industrial society, children have become a very expensive hobby. Somehow or other, the way an industrial society looks, we see the family gradually, this big, what they call the joint family in India, the extended family, where everybody lives together, all the brothers, the parents, their sons, their wives, this big situation, this effect of modern life is it gradually breaks down. And in an industrial society, children no longer become economically productive. They go to school, which is a kind of babysitting for the most place. They don't really get an education, but they're just not, nobody can do anything with them. They can be engaged, so we'll pretend we're giving them an education by putting them in schools. So a lot of times you find out that they don't really get that much education. And then if they actually want to do something, then they have to go to many years of school. So they don't become economically productive until they're 30 or something like that. And they go off, the parents, everybody separates, the children go here, wherever the jobs are, they leave. It costs, right now in the United States, they say to raise a child to the age of 18 costs about $350,000. So you notice that when people get married nowadays, they have to worry, can we afford to have a child? See, having a children is a disaster. Because they cost so much money. And so people very carefully, first of all, you don't have children until later. You get married, but not till 10 years later. Women are now having their first babies at the age of, you know, past 35. Because you have to wait till you have money. She has to work too now. You can't, you know, separately. So that's a big thing. Once you start taking time off work to have a child, you know, that's another disaster. In addition to what the child costs, your income goes down. So basically, people stop having children. People have noticed this is the problem in advanced industrial countries. People stop reproducing. And the only way Germany has laborers is people come in from foreign countries, you know, Turkey and other places. In America, they have to come from Mexico. There are lots of people there because these places are still not industrialized. So they're still having children with pre-industrial enthusiasm. They think they're great. And we see somebody, oh, you have four children. Isn't that irresponsible? Isn't that low class? You know, isn't that horrible? But they're still rooted in the old system where children were an asset. They haven't quite realized that this is not their... They're nothing but money. You educate them, you spend all of, they go away, and you know, you get a card on your birthday, and you see them once a year, and they don't take care of you when you're old. That's not their business anymore. You know, so the whole family is breaking up. So people stop having children. This is, you know, right now in the West, we can always bring in people from industrialized countries. What will happen when the whole world is industrialized? Anybody have any idea? Well, they're working on it. Artificial wombs, factories to make babies. No, this Aldous Huxley wrote this book, Brave New World, and in the 30s, I guess, or 40s, the future where modern reproductive technologies, the babies would be maybe in factories, because if they don't do it, and then of course they were genetically designed. So that they would have different levels of intelligence and so on. So you got a servant class of, you know, and so on. The brave new world. But people are seriously thinking about this, what to do, because nobody's having babies anymore. The other question is this good for spiritual life? Or is it even good for human life? Because we also find that the number one problem in the world as far as health goes is mental illness. The World Health Organization says this, that the number one problem is mental illness. Because people are very, very disturbed. I think that for people to be mentally, emotionally secure, they need to have a childhood in where they have a father and a mother. They need two things. They need to feel very protected, and they need to be very nourished, cared for. Traditionally, the man, the father, is the protector, and the mother is the nourisher. I recently read one book which was talking about this. But they wouldn't say father and mother anymore. They said the protective figure and the nourishing figure. Because sometimes both are men or both are women, or sometimes the woman is the protector, the father is the nourisher, and so on. But it still seems that really one becomes the protector and another becomes the nourisher. It's very hard to do both at the same time. They really require different mentalities and different skills and different outlook on life, practically. So the people are either specialized as the protector and specialized as the nourisher. Well, all the Vedic system says that basically that the men are more naturally, essentially by nature, the male nature is to be protector and the female nature is to be nourisher. Now, once you start talking about people having natures, immediately modern people become upset. They say, this is essentialist thinking. We have no natures. We make ourselves over and do anything we want. But the real thing is that actually there are men and there are women, and as a rule, what the Vedic system is that the men should be the men and the women should be the women. It really, on the whole, works better that way. That's all really they're saying. And so the reason that women should be protected is that let's say that there's masculine characters, there's a bunch of characters, there's a masculine, and there's certain characteristics that are feminine. So that now we see that I've seen women, they be going to the army, they become jet pilots, and they're as good as anybody else, but they're also very much like men. Well, so you can successfully do that. It's true. And of course, I know plenty of men that are very much like women. I mean, that we see there's a certain amount of play in the system. But the Vedic system is let the women be women, and by being protected, the gentle, soft, nurturing, feminine sort of a thing can develop very nicely. While the man does the protecting thing. It doesn't mean a woman is not sometimes capable of taking care of herself. I mean, you know, she can become, work in the world like a man, but it changes the personality. So that's when you have women who are protected, as here, the point is that he left her under the care of her son. Right? So she's still taken care of. And because the son is Kapiladeva, we see how nicely she's taken care of in a spiritual way. I mean, just incredibly. But by being under the care of the son, again, all the is it possible to develop these feminine qualities and sustain them? Not really trained to be independent like a man, and you could say, well, she missed out in life, but no, there's a whole other area of life in which she has access to because of that protection. So this is the thing, and the main thing is that in an economy where children are an asset, you see, then motherhood becomes very important. Right now, you see, people think of motherhood as a kind of a waste of time. A woman has been educated, now she's a lawyer or a doctor, and she has to take this time out for motherhood. It's just, you know, people say, oh man, you could have done so much, now she has to be a mother. We forget that children are human beings. I mean, we don't think anymore that people are the product of a society. And that you really ought to really raise a generation of people who are psychologically healthy, well-balanced, and intelligent, and so on like this. And so one of the things that will become clear to people, I hope in the future with the industrial economy, is that we are in fact destroying our future, because this is not good for raising well-rounded, sane children who become adults. So as society becomes more advanced, the people seem to become worse and worse and worse as they come up, because who teaches them anymore? You know, that what they call the, you heard the one-eyed guru, the television set. They learn life from television. So this is why, and especially if you understand that the purpose of life is self-realization, then the idea is one should be satisfied with the things that are available naturally. Doesn't mean there's no technology or anything like that, but that it's not only those things that are necessary and useful. Right now, so much of it just, even if we have automobiles, it's perfectly possible the engineers can manufacture an automobile that will last 100 years. Hey, you have to change some parts now and then, but basically it wouldn't break down, it would keep on going, it would be simple to change, you know, anybody could fix it. Why do they have to have a new model every year? It's just a waste. It's all for other things than just simply transport. It's for status, it's for sentence, and for unnecessary consumption. The cars have to be, you know, have to be obsolete within a few years, so you have to get a new one. And the automobile industry has this system, they call it planned obsolescence, that it will, they plan so that you'll have to buy a new one. But if you had an automobile industry that was not in the mode of passion, you could make basically your basic sedan, your basic truck, your basic van, and three different cars, and they would all last for a long time. And all with the same pretty much parts, so you wouldn't have to go to so many different manufacturers with so many different parts or so much. But that won't work nowadays, because this is all the mode of passion, and the mode of passion means huge unnecessary labor for sense gratification, but the result of the mode of passion is misery. This is stated by Krishna. The tamo rajagun leads to misery, suffering. Happiness is, if you really want any happiness, even material happiness, really that requires satvaguna, the mode of goodness. One should be elevated. But modern society, our standard of advancement is all the standard of the mode of passion. When the leaders get together of the countries, they don't discuss spiritual advancement. They discuss economic development. Then once in a while, they say, isn't this a little crass? We should talk about the quality of life. But it turns out the quality of life means economic development. They can't think of anything else, really. So they don't know what to do about this. So that's the that's our predicament. So as we make progress and things get better, they get worse and worse and worse. This is what's happening. Prabhupada had no real faith in the future of industrial society. It's a hypertrophy, an overdevelopment of the mode of passion. And like any overdevelopment, it'll be replaced by probably another extreme difficulty. Usually what happens when there's too much of the mode of passion, the result is the mode of ignorance. Because people suffer so much, and because they don't know any way out of their suffering, they simply have to take refuge more and more in escapism. escapism means, well, first of all, intoxication, drugs. If most of how much society depends now upon drugs, legal and illegal, to for people to keep on going. I know a guy in America who works in the construction industry, and any time the boss wants them to do some extra work, stay late and work, he would hand out amphetamine speed to them. Then not only would they get time and a half, that 50% more wages per hour, but also they'd all be happy. And they'd have full of energy. And they just, as a matter of course, they would pass out the amphetamines. It's just extraordinary. And then so many people are on antidepressants. In America, somebody wrote a book called Prozac. That was the most fashionable antidepressant. Prozac Nation. Because so many people are just basically drugged all the time for so many different things. That's just the legal ones. The illegal ones are enormous. I mean, I think people are probably afraid to look at the whole situation. So this is how life goes on. And these intoxicants are all, this is all manifestations of the mode of ignorance. In the mode of goodness, there is happiness and development of knowledge. The result of the mode of passion, people are dedicated to sense gratification, but the result is the mode of ignorance. And the mode of ignorance is there's not knowledge and there's not sense gratification, there's just dullness, depression, and hardship, and that's what's going to happen. So Prabhupada, many things that Prabhupada says now, like what he says about men and women, almost from the context of the modern industrial society, it just seems people can't even understand it. It's either sexist or just really old-fashioned or just bewildering. But if you understand the perspective, the Vedic perspective, where what Prabhupada talks about, the system of varna and ashram, these things will naturally develop. Actually, if one has an agrarian society, and we return to that, as I said, I think we'll be forced to do that anyway. You won't have any choice. I mean, first of all, it will simply have to be that food production and energy production will be as local as possible. So it doesn't mean technology will disappear off the face of the earth either. They'll still be. It won't be like the Middle Ages, but whatever they were like, we don't know for sure. This will happen, and really, Prabhupada has given us all the instructions we need for this kind of future. We want to when people become distressed, sufficiently distressed because of this overdevelopment of the mode of passion, some will just go more and more in the mode of ignorance. But the other thing is you bail out of this and to the mode of goodness and go in the other direction, where we can have a constructive spiritual society. And that spiritual society doesn't mean material misery or no sense gratification. One is not necessary to suffer like crazy, but sense gratification is there simply that one can lead a healthy life. We just take what we need and nothing extra, and our excess human energy that is used for spiritual realization, we will be completely satisfied in this way. And so now we'll see in the verses to come up, we'll see. Here we have by the bank of a river, bank of this lake, this Bindu Sarovar lake, we see the very simple seeing people are living on a little garden and roots and berries and things like that. Kapila Deva will instruct Devahuti in this highest knowledge. You notice that even though Devahuti is a woman, she's still capable of hearing and understanding completely well. I think she makes some remarks about how unqualified she is, but that's natural for a devotee to think like that. All devotees think like that if they're real devotees. But you see, she's very, very intelligent and very capable of understanding the teachings of her son, who is, in fact, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's called in this verse Bhagavan Kapila. It is an incarnation of the Lord. So this philosophy comes free from any taint of speculation. It's really what we need to know. Okay, any questions or comments? Oh, by the way, Prabhupada gave a series of lectures on these chapters, and they're published in a book. Is that translated into the teachings of Lord Kapila?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In German?
In German? Yeah. Teachings of Lord Kapila. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, because Prabhupada's lectures that he gave on, I think it was in Bombay, he gave this whole series of lectures edited and published as a separate book. And it's very nice to read along with this chapter. Yeah, it's really coming in. Okay, any questions? Yeah. Yes.
We see that Mother Devaki is one of the examples, and there are many such examples of very intelligent women in Vedic society. You said that if they are protected nicely, they automatically develop all nice qualities.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any education also for the women in the Vedic society, or they just get grooming at home mostly?
Well, that was also an education. There wasn't necessarily. It wasn't that generally in the Vedic society, it was boys who were sent to Gurukul to live in the house of the spiritual master, and the mothers and the daughters stayed at home. But also somehow they received an education under those circumstances, just different system. It wasn't necessary, because when boys would go to the Gurukula, I mean, that was a tough school, you know. I mean, they were brahmacharis, and it was very, very difficult. A girl stayed at home. But what they were supposed to end up supposed to knowing was quite a bit. Somehow, at least if they were from Brahminical families, they would end up knowing Sanskrit. You see, like, for example, Chaitanya's mother, she could talk philosophy perfectly well. Somehow there was some system where they learned all these things. I don't know exactly what the institution was. I have had to study it somewhere. Of course, in the Mahabharata, when Prabhupada established Gurukuls, girls did go to Gurukuls. So it's not a... because apparently you couldn't arrange anything at home at that time. But if it, so they were appropriately educated. There's a list of the 64 arts that women were supposed to know, and if you look at that list, it's better than you get today at any university education. Poetry, metallurgy, all kinds of things are listed in these 64 arts. I can find the list if you want. Now I have this computer here like a memory. Any other questions? Yeah? Yeah?
I just was, when you were speaking about this development of economic, industrial civilization, I was just reflecting that maybe it's because for maybe 100 or 200 years was almost nothing. It just progressed now, and now it's rapid development, very, very, you know, too much at the moment, and it's going quicker and quicker. I was just thinking, maybe it just was arrangement for Prabhupada to quickly spread Krishna consciousness, because I meet many people now in Germany. There's a big concern. Many people want to go to the land. It's kind of...
Yeah, sure.
So, like, many people becoming frustrated already, and many people... So that seemed to be... was the point where there would be enough of devotees to take care of each and every community, and you don't need to travel so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, just...
Yeah, sure. It's, you know, the industrialization has been a gradual... It began at the, you know, end of the 18th century. But, you know, you'll notice, for example, that the industrialization of agriculture did not really happen, really in any big scale until after World War II. There was still farm machinery. But what's happened since then is the family farm has died out and the agribusiness has taken over. And that now, of course, then you have... they're supposed to come in the beginning. You have agribusiness and you have genetically engineered food stuff and gigantic, huge farms with gigantic machinery, monster machinery. And of course, hyper-fertilization and irrigation, destroying the land like crazy, ultimately. Here's a list of the 64 arts. I won't read them all, but I'll just read the beginning. Gita, the art of singing. Vadya, musical instruments. Nritya, dancing. Natya, theatrical arts. Alekya, painting. So many of them like that. Painting the body, making covered flowers for the beds. Jewels. So a lot of them are cosmetic and various things like that. Cooking is one of them. One is Hastalagava, you know, doing magical tricks with your hands, making all kinds of drinks, needlework, weaving, playing with thread, playing on a lute, making and solving riddles. reciting verses from memory, reciting books, making plays, art of testing silver and jewelry, Dhatuvada, the art of metallurgy, Vrikshandra Veda Yoga, art of practicing medical treatment by herbs. Anyway, they go on like this, knowing different provincial dialects. Language of the folk, amulets, art of conversation, art of mentally composing verses, kriya vikalpa, art of designing a literary work or medical remedy. So anyway, there's gambling, art of playing with dice, art of enforcing discipline. That's all. Anyway, this is quite an education. So I think generally people were much, much better educated in the past than they are at present. Actually, they had better brains too. Yeah. So it's true that things are going. We've got this. And now the other thing has happened about the Industrial Revolution, the invention of computers. What that really means is that office work, which used to be what they call white-collar work, you know, this blue-collar, the people that work in the factories, and white-collar, I don't know if you have the same expression in German, the factory workers and office workers, the blue shirts for the factory workers and the white shirts and the tie for the office workers, right? So now what's happened to with computers is that office work has become factory work. Because now you sit in your little cubicle and you have a computer, and there's a program that somebody made, and you just follow the program like a machine. And somebody, your boss, can look at every keystroke. So it's just become like a factory. Even medicine has become much more. It's all industrial now. So the computers, what computers have done, is to take an industrialization to all kinds of areas that formerly were free from this. The methods of industrialization, everybody doing the same thing all the time, being guided by a program that told you what to do. You know, look how doctors work now. They have their computer system, and it's all machinery, you know. The guy barely looks at you, you know. He just looks, here's the tests, and look at the test scores, and what you've got, and looks it up on the computer. Except there's a little handheld to tell them everything. You know?
I thought they had like 70% wrong diagnosis in Germany.
Yeah.
70% wrong diagnosis.
No, it's really true. You go to a physician and they don't even look at you practically. You know, you're just a thing. So this industrialization, it just keeps taking over more and more of life. Yeah, it's still on.
From here you see that we are going away from agrarian culture. In India, there are farmers who are committing suicide because government is not supporting them. And the government is saying, go grow this particular kind of cash crops, mm-hmm. but they cannot eat cash crops.
Yeah, that's right.
So, this is going
what is
on.
This cash crops?
Sugar cane, which you can export to the...
Cash crop means something you grow just for selling.
Okay.
Like you grow tobacco.
Not the thing.
If you grow tobacco or something, you can't eat it, you can't live, all you can do is sell it. So everybody grows cash crops now. Used to be you grow everything you had to live on for yourself, right? Now you just grow crops for selling. And then you go to the store and you buy frozen food to eat. That's somebody else's cash crop. Why do that, you know? It's so strange. Yeah,
they are opening now. They have Walmart outlets now, about 200 Walmart outlets in India. Mm-hmm. And Reliance is opening something in the same line as...
I might say Walmart has failed in Germany for some reason. Back down.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah. So, as a devotee, what is our duty? Do we also have some responsibility to create some examples like having...
Yes, Prabhupada really wanted that. You know, that's why he started these farms communities to do this, to set the example. Unfortunately, there's not yet, at least in any developed country, in ISKCON, a self-sufficient farm. Because, but like for example, Gita Nagari, I mean, not far from where I live. At first, they were training oxen with plows and plowing with the oxen and so on, lots of cows and everything. So we had cows and oxen, but no devotees to do it. No, it was very hard to get somebody to slow down for 120. Kilometers an hour. that's somehow or other. Every single that I know of is just all these farms turned into basically a suburb, where people were living out in the countryside, but not really in the city, but still not living like self-sufficient farms. So this is still a program for the future. Where we do have farms at work is where you have to do it. In Brazil, in the former communist countries, that is Romania, you know, places like that. Even in Cuba, you know, when Cuba was, when the government, the American government, stopped all oil going into Cuba by... they started flying with oxen again too. So when you have to do it, but my conviction is that people will change when they don't have a choice. I mean, why did people move from the farms and go to the cities? Part of it is they just, I don't know, they want the mode of passion, they want excitement, and because, I mean, you have to really, you know, farming is, you really have to be in the mode of goodness to like it.
They don't want this hard work.
Yeah, and it's very hard work. Yeah, it's true, it is very hard work. The only people I know that really like it were ones that grew up that way. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard to find anybody who's grown up that way anymore. You know? But so the transition is a little difficult. Also, I have to say, you know, when you look at how industrialization took place, a lot of people were forced off the land. The government cooperated with industry to force people to leave the land so they could come and work in the factories. I mean, a lot of this stuff, if you look like why I grow a cash crop, which I can't eat, because it's all of one thing. You know, maybe it's tomatoes, I can eat tomatoes, but I've got, you know, so many hectares of tomatoes. You sell it. You know, I don't grow any. That's sold somewhere else, and somebody else is growing over there. You know what I need. I could grow everything locally, but somehow or other, it's the arrangement is that whatever I grow is sold somewhere else, and I buy from somewhere else whatever I need. Why? Because there's somebody in the middle making a profit. That's all I can think. That's the only reason. There are people who will make all this arrangement and own the transport and own the companies and own the factories that freeze it or can it and everything that are making a profit.
They are destroying
these. Yeah, of course they are.
Destroying the land.
Yeah, they do. They destroy the land. They destroy human life. They destroy everywhere. I guess they don't know what they're doing. It's just ignorance. It's just ignorance. But if you say to any woman, "Would you like to go back? Would you like to have 8 children?" Who's going to say yes?
generations.
Remember, because in India, you know what they say in India to bride? May you be the mother of a 100 sons. <And you're> Of course, those 100 came out all at once in that case when they're talking about. But that's like a benediction. May you have so many children. So we have, our mentality is very different.
Guruji, we were just talking about this agrarian life and industrial development, modern civilization and all these things. I was just talking the same topic with my professor in the university. He's teacher of environmental science. He said, we live on business. He said, we live on business.
We live on business.
And that's why we have to do it. We have no other choice.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, the universities, they're also part of the same system.
I feel very confused.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the whole idea, is to confuse you.
Or to follow.
Well, you know, part of our difficulty in ISKCON is that everyone is tied into the system. Like, for example, if you want to start Varnashram Dharma, because we're talking about this. The first thing is that if you want to be a Brahmin, if you're a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, or a Vaishya by nature, but you're one of those three, you cannot get a paycheck. As soon as you get a paycheck, you're a Shudra. To be an employee, is to be a Shudra. The Brahmanas were economically independent. They lived on donations, and if they didn't charity, and if it didn't come, then they were just austere. Kshatriyas, well, each of them had their own little area in which they were the lived on taxes and fines and, you know, whatever. Vaishya meant self-employed. either your farm was your own or your own business, but self-employed, entrepreneur, not a businessman who works for some country and gets his salary. Only if you get a paycheck from somebody, you're a Shudra. But now the world is so arranged that you can't live. Everyone is a Shudra. It's just the Kali Yuga, everybody's a Shudra. It's a fact. The priests get paid. They get wages. They get a paycheck. The military gets a paycheck. The presidents of the company, country get a paycheck. Everyone gets a paycheck. Except for you. Because you're a Brahmin. it's just not designed, so you really want to practice it. It's very, very hard in this system. Because the idea was that Brahmin, Kshatriya, and Vaishya were all capable of independent action. Like if you wanted to see if a person was a Vaishya or a Shudra, you give them $10,000 or euros, huh? If they come back with 20, they're a Vaishya. If they want, we'll come back and they need more, they need to be an employee. Somebody has to tell them. That's the system. That's how you could see. Yeah.
But isn't it that even in this situation, if we really practice or we really have faith in Krishna, one can still be detached from the
system? Yeah, you have to get along. But I'm just talking about you deal with it as best you can, you're detached. But I'm saying if you really want to change the system, it's very, very difficult. It's very, very, very difficult. He's saying what to do.
In the start itself, before starting this something, we feel so much frustrated because I see only my defeat, because the Maya, the force is so strong, it's going in one direction, all 100 people. How can I go alone?
Well, we're not alone.
Still we are very big.
Yeah. As
compared to millions and billions. Yeah.
But all I can think to do is we should get our own organization together. We should have more confidence in this, what Prabhupada has said, because so many people have doubts about it. Practice Krishna consciousness, and it will be Krishna's arrangement that at the right time, so many things will just be ready. And I'm sure this is happening. You know, my understanding is that it's Krishna's in charge of timing. Srila Prabhupada was told by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur to go to the West in what was in 1936. And Prabhupada, well, for whatever reason, did not actually show up until basically, 30 years later. And he even remarked, you know, he wrote one letter to the disciple that my spiritual master told me to come to the West in 1936 to come to the West, but I was such a rascal I could not do anything until my old age, he said. But if you imagine that say Prabhupada came to the West or came to America say in 1955 instead of 1965, you know, well, it's not the right time, but he probably just came at just the right time where there was a whole group of people open to hear from him and listen to him. And Prabhupada was expecting that when he came to America, because Bhagavatam was so elevated that he was thinking that the intellectual people, the really highly cultured, advanced people, they would be the ones to receive it. But they weren't interested at all, because they're like your people, you know, they're all going off in another direction. But somehow or other, there were these young people that somehow or other Krishna had waiting for him. So this is just to show that sometimes we can't see how things are going, but somehow or other Krishna is making arrangements. And I also think ISKCON is having a big effect. sometimes we don't realize how much of the things we say and do, how they're going out into the culture. Affecting people in different ways, because so many of the things that Prabhupada said now are becoming almost commonplace, and there's many people who, for example, just to give an example, you know, there are many animal rights groups and vegetarian groups. And one god sister of mine, for some time, she got a job with this group called PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, a kind of aggressive animal rights group. And she's told me, she says, I was amazed in this organization how many people in this organization at one time of their lives were going to temples regularly, living in temples for a while and so on, another thing. Now they're not like practicing Krishna consciousness, but somehow or other this animal rights thing has become, somehow they learn. Because Prabhupada said, I remember reading when I was a new devotee in the 60s, how Prabhupada said that in the Bhagavatam it referred to, there's this passage where the living entities in the country are called Praja, and he said Praja means citizens, and actually the king has to protect all the citizens, which means the animals. And when I thought about it, I said, well, that means that animals have what we call civil rights, you know, that the government has to observe. I mean, that is so radical an idea. So we used to talk about that a lot, at least I used to talk about it a lot. And it was just such a strange idea to people. But now, you know, in law school, there are now people who are taking law. It's not very successful in the courts yet, trying to represent a forest or a stream or the fish or the... You know, it's just that idea has somehow gone into the mainstream. So you'll find many things in Prabhupada that just sound so weird that you'll see in the future will become normal. And then the civil rights for animals, what terrifies everybody, as soon as somebody has some recognition of it, we should go in and say we want to represent the cows. We'll see. And then even this comes up, you know, in America there's this Oprah Winfrey, have you heard of her? She's this lady that has this extremely popular program, mostly women watch it. And sometimes when she reads a book and really likes the book, and she brings the author on her program, and then, you know, that book sells millions and millions of copies. She's like a very, very big person. So she had this gentleman who wrote a book on her show. And this person, I think his name is Lehman. He actually came in to talk to the North American Temple presidents once. He was a beef farmer in America, raising cattle, and he got very, very sick, and with heart disease and everything else. And he became a vegetarian, and his sickness went away. And now he's a very aggressive advocate of vegetarianism, and very interesting because he's a former cow, you know, beef farmer. He repents his ways and everything, and so he has this goes around giving lectures against meat eating that are really heavy. So he came on her show, and he described to her, you know, the whole process of killing animals and how they're the hormones and all the artificial things and what it does to your body, you know. And Oprah says, she exclaims at the end of his presentation, I'm never going to eat a hamburger again. She says like that. And after she said that, beef sales dropped all over America. So then she was sued because the Cattle Grower Association of Texas, you see, Texas is where they grow these beef cattle, and they have a powerful organization, and they had managed to get the government to pass a law against blaspheming food. Food Defamation Act. That was because some people sometimes would start rumors that some kind of juice is bad for you or it's poisonous or something, and then, so the government passed this law that you cannot say bad things about food that's not true. So on the basis of that law, she was sued by this Cattlemen's Association, and the trial, the court proceedings were to take place in a small Texas town that was in the middle of cattle beef raising country in Texas. I mean, the whole economy of this town depended on beef. So they thought that for sure they would win the case because everybody in that town, everybody depended upon this. And so this was a big mistake they made because she won. because here's this little town in Texas, and when Oprah Winfrey comes there, you know, everybody, she's like the biggest thing that happened in that little town for 100 years, you know. And every day while she was on trial, she would broadcast her show from that town. So all these local people were on television. So slowly things are changing. Okay, we better stop.
So you told that technology development is actually in the reverse direction of the spiritual thing, if you have to, you know, compare. Is it fine to use technology, let's take for agricultural use, you know, there is a lot of advanced technology which is enabling higher possibilities from the land and the yield.
Yeah, but you have to look and see what the long-term results are, because a lot of this technology is short-term big results and long-term devastation. So there's this guy named Schumacher, he wrote a book called Small is Beautiful, I think. And he points out that because what modern agriculture does with super fertilization and super irrigation, as the long-term result is it destroys the land. Because first of all, the deep plowing, the wind blows the soil away. Super fertilization makes the land sterile. You have to keep fertilizing after that. There's no worms, no nothing in there. It's not natural land. Hyper-irrigation. Irrigation gradually builds up salt in the land. So the long-term result is no land. And so Schumacher said that basically you're like somebody who's living on the capital. You know, you have your money in the bank, you should live on the interest of the investment, not the capital. So we're living on our capital. So the technology is okay itself, maybe it's neutral. But if you use it to get a short-term gain at a long-term cost, then that's definitely the mode of passion. And so these people just have to look ahead 100 years what will happen. And you know what they think? Yeah, it's causing a problem, but in 100 years we'll figure out some more technology to solve it.
Actually, technology is just, it's breeding problem after problem. We have to make another technology to solve.
Yeah, that's what they always think, you know. The problems of technology can be solved by technology. There are already engineers that are thinking, okay, we can solve global warming. In outer space, we'll put up these giant, like, blinds. You know, like these blinds you have, you can turn, and we'll just put these big screens and regulate the sunlight that comes to the Earth, you know, no problem.
My understanding is that the technology will atone to that, because actually they didn't need technology before.
No, they don't.
It's artificial need, so maybe ultimately the society will come, like what they do in Hungarian farms. They don't have any electricity there. Mm-hmm. They have everything maximal. Okay, they use some computers still, but you cannot drop.
But you could just pedal your bicycle and use the power of the computer.
But the point is that you will not need a computer also after some.
Well, maybe not, but you know, in America now, for 100 years. They're building dams everywhere. You know, the Army Corps of Engineers damming all the rivers and, you know, this and that thing. Now they're tearing down every one of them, almost. They're just tearing down dams because they cause so much difficulty and so much trouble.
Okay. Yeah. Artificial arrangement of humans.
Look what happened to the Rhine River. Nothing's living in there anymore because the whole river is like one, it's like a sewer, you know, with steel on all the sides, and it doesn't go anywhere. You know? And pretty soon they're going to have to bring it back alive again and basically take down everything. Why? Because they don't want floods, and they don't want, you know, high and low, and make it nice on the bank. And so.
They want to escape the natural result, but they come in another way.
Yeah, so it's just...
It's a mental disease and stuff.
Yeah, it always... It's, so the rulers, so, huh?
They want to be the rulers, not
that's
God
right.
should be the ruler.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. When we try to become God, we're not up to the job. We just can't do it, we always mess up.
The money should come and you could buy all and have to do nothing.
That's right, that's right. Won't work. So you have a technology, but you really have to look at the whole scene. It has to be very appropriate to exactly what the minimum amount and the least amount of technology for the most results. But you know, these people want to make money, so the what they want is the most technology with the smallest result. Yeah, that is so.
Employment everywhere.
Yeah.
They don't have employment. The more technology develops, the less employees you need.
Well,
but
so
they employ all around. They employ the people, the nature. All.
Yeah, then they all become. I know what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay.
And everybody comes dependent on them. Yeah, for everything.
Thank you.
It was a class to begin the revolution.